I'm from Mandan, North Dakota. I work in Bismarck, North Dakota. Just by way of, should you ever want to get in touch with me, just write to Alcohol State Capitol, Bismarck. I got a letter there that said, Booze Department, State Capitol, Bismarck, and I...
You're the big boozer.
Yeah. But the three great lies in the society are the check is in the mail, and of course I'll respect you in the morning, and I work for the state and I'm here to help. And, so I'd like to very briefly, in the brief hour we have, touch on some real highlights and only highlights of this complex disease, alcoholism. And to begin, I wonder if you would stand and join me with the prayer on the board. Let me just read it for you if you cannot read it. It says, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Will you join me? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And as a further devotion, and I'll explain in a minute why I'm doing this, I wonder if I could ask you three, or whoever would like to, as you pass it down, to read, read one section, and somebody else do the meditation, and the third prayer. Okay, just pass it on to whoever can and is willing.
Where are we starting for the meditation for the day? Is that?
Read from the very top.
On the 15th or 16th. But even faith is not the whole story. There must be service. We must give this thing away if we want to keep it. The Dead Sea has no outlet, and it is stagnant and full of salt. The Sea of Galilee is clear and clean and blue as the Jordan River runs, as the Jordan River carries it out to irrigate the desert. To be of service to other people, make our lives worth living. Does service to others give me a real purpose in life?
Meditation for the day. Seek God early in the day before he gets crowded out of life's problems, difficulties, or pleasures. In that early quiet time, gain a calm, strong confidence in the goodness and purpose of the universe. Do not seek God only when the world's struggles prove too much and too many for you to bear or face alone. Seek God early when you can have a consciousness of God's Spirit in the world. People often only seek God when their difficulties are too great to be surmounted in any other way, forgetting that if they sought God's companionship before they needed it, many of the difficulties would never arise.
The prayer for the day. I pray that I may not let God be crowded out by the hurly-burly of life. I pray that I may seek God early and often.
Thank you.
What we have just done is the standard opening for either or both a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or the standard group treatment setting, at least in our state, and I think this is true across the nation. I've titled the I'd never heard the term oxymoron before I was introduced to it yesterday, but I thought of this whole concept in my work in alcoholism as dealing always with the yin and the yang, or the good and the very best and the very most evil, the most suffering and the most delight. And I thought about it in terms of paradoxes. And oxymoron, I think I'll use more because it describes for me this concept of alcoholism from the standpoint of a Christian and from the standpoint of my work with suffering alcoholics. So if you can think, how do we say this now? If you can think oxymoronically with me, Think with me for a minute that this whole illness, alcoholism, is a really a kind of a delightful disaster or a welcome catastrophe. And we could use similar terms like that. It certainly is not that we would, or I would wish pain, I would wish on no one the kind of suffering that alcoholism brings. And I'll try to describe a little bit of that in a minute. I'm sure many of you are aware of that pain, either personally or indirectly. But nowhere else, I'm a psychologist and have been of both a teaching and a practicing psychologist for a number of years. Nobody ever got well when I was doing all this aham business and altering egos and all this nonsense. Boy, I deal with alcoholics, they get well every day. Every day they get well. And when they get well, they get weller than well. Weller than well. They're stronger than they ever were before. There's something about a new lease on life that alcoholics have. And what we've just read comes from a little book that's typically called the 24-hour book. Most alcoholics, and by the way, most pastors that I know who work with alcoholics carry the book and read this kind of meditation every day. So if you think there's a mystery, that there's a cult or whatever, that's a fairly typical reading, and that was the reading for the day. It's the spirit of service to others. It's the spirit of daily growth, of daily spiritual, and we hope, but don't insist, that it be spiritual or Christian. But it's the daily spiritual growth that is absolutely essential for recovery. Now, I should say, by the way, that one of the national leaders in the field is a Lutheran clergyman and one of our own kind, if I can use that term, named John Keller. John is on my faculty each summer in North Dakota at the International School of Alcohol Studies, and he continually singles me out. And I was surprised at first by this, and now I'm just very pleased every time he does it. But he points out that I'm the single state director and perhaps one of the only bureaucrats in the field. I tend to think of myself, by the way, not as a bureaucrat, but as a clinocrat. But I'm the only clinocrat in the field that insists on spiritual treatment for alcoholism. I think I would too with similar mental illnesses. But to me, it's so commonplace. So I guess I'm saying it may not be true where you're from. It may be that there are treatment centers that do not use this approach. If they don't, obviously I'm saying they're wrong and they haven't discovered the full meaning of treatment. So that's not only a bias, that's a position I would insist upon if I were working with them. Well, let's back up a minute and think about this problem of alcoholism, and first of all about the problem of alcohol. Alcohol, like sex, is something Lutherans don't have. And we certainly don't have difficulty with it and don't talk about it very much. Frankly, our church has very little to be proud of in the area of alcohol ethics. But frankly, our nation has even less to be proud of. The American society is known as the most alcoholic society in the nation, and we live with that. And we really aren't sure why we spend $1 billion a year advertising the use of the mood-altering drug, beverage alcohol, why people have difficulty with it. You know, every day, I work in the state capitol and live in a smaller town across the Missouri River named Mandan. And every day I drive by, every day I'm in my office, I drive by one permanent billboard. And you perhaps know the billboard. I'm sure that the men in the audience will know immediately what I'm talking about when I mention the Black Velvet Lady, okay? I don't know what she does for you girls, but for most of us, she piques a certain kind of interest. Having been not only Lutheran, but a practicing heterosexual all my life, I immediately identify with this billboard. The Black Velvet Lady is always prone, right? And she's telling me, as I go across the bridge every day for 5 years, she's telling me sometimes to touch the velvet. And later on, about every 6 weeks, they were changing the billboards. And later on, she's telling me to feel the velvet. Doesn't take me a whole long time to jump in to think about what she's going to ask me to do in the next 6 weeks. I kind of look forward to the changing of the billboard, you see. Well, I told this story not long ago, and my son was with me, and he said, "Dad, does the billboard have a picture of the bottle of whiskey?" I said, "Andrew, how would I know that? I've only seen the billboard for 5 years. How would I know whether there's a bottle of whiskey on it?" Well, so he became interested in it, as he's becoming more interested in young ladies anyway, but he became somehow interested in this billboard in laughing at me. And what did they do when I expect them to make, how can they go further than feel the velvet? What do they do? Now they have George Burns selling whiskey. God himself is selling. Well, think about this crazy American ethic. If you want to read about it, by the way, the two books I'd recommend. One is a book by Rohrbach called The Alcoholic Republic. Rohrbach comes from Washington. It's his doctoral dissertation in history. It's devastating, just devastating. You know, one of the things he mentions is that the Pilgrims, or the Puritans, when they came to this country, were distressed because the crew took all the beer away from it. These guys didn't know that they could drink the beer in this country. That's where our nation started, or at least where we think Puritans were it started. I learned from that book that Manhattan, which of course people bought from the Indians for $23, Manhattan, and this was at a ceremony, Manhattan itself means, and I think it's Mohican, but I can't recall the dialect, means place where we all got drunk. You know, our nation started on the most alcoholic principles. Now, the second book I'd suggest and describes very painfully but very humorously is a book by Chidsey, C-H-I-D-S-E-Y, hard to get, but you can get it in libraries, I know, called On and Off the Wagon, A Sobering History of the Temperance Movement in the United States. And this is painful but hilarious. And here he brings in the entirety of the temperance movement, the involvement of the church, or at least the church leaders, the ludicrousness of crazy caring nation, running around the country, breaking up bars, shouting, smash for the love of Jesus, smash. And she was put in a mental institution shortly that after that. But somehow our whole nation drank very heavily, relied on it as we still do, and the churches, including the Lutheran Church, took no position on it, and we still don't, still don't. In the state of North Dakota, and you probably have similar statistics if you ever want to look them up in your state, in the state of North Dakota, we take in $6.2 million. We're a very small state. $6.2 million from alcohol beverage taxes. We spend $3 million or less on treatment of alcoholism. Now, your state probably has something different. Our whole government, you see, is profiting from this very drug. While we're concerned about cocaine and marijuana and many other drugs, they don't begin to cause the massive sort of problem that alcohol does. Still, our church stays silent. Last month, was a consultant to the LCA, and as was John Keller, Phil Hansen, and some other names that you may recognize. Then we began to look at, I was proud of the church and its leaders for beginning to look at the attitude that the church might have. But consider this for a minute. John Keller said from the podium, consider your first reaction to this statement, that alcohol is one of God's great gifts and should be welcomed and used appropriately. Now, I don't know where you come from on that, but every fiber in my body sort of reacts to that, because I can remember Pastor Schultz, when I was a little one, telling me alcohol was evil and dirty. And yet we all knew that Pastor Schultz, who was German, had a few bumps on the side. Somehow we've equated alcohol with so much evil that and the problem then is that the person with the disease alcoholism is then equated as an evil person. Well, I'm not suggesting I have the answer to what the church's position is, but Lutherans, like most other congregations, are notorious for voting and talking dry and drinking wet. In my clinical practice, by the way, I've had clergymen, I've had persons from all professions, but I've had clergymen from all denominations, including a bishop, Catholic bishop. That was as close as I ever really got to God with him. And he reminded me of that every day we met, too, that I was very close. There was, however, a little Irish nun in that treatment group who hated this guy and brought him down step by step. She didn't think he was very close to God at all. But the point is that spirituality, or at least the veneer of spirituality, is really provides us with no immunity to this disease. Anyway, it's all by way of saying, and we could explore this further, and it's a fun thing to explore, that our history is so alcoholic, and yet the main church bodies have taken almost no position. The Jews have, the Mediterranean peoples have, the Catholics to a greater extent have, Lutherans, Presbyterians, and so on have not. Methodists, Southern Baptists are primarily prohibitionists, but even at this Lutheran conference, which included people from Canada, Ohio, Kansas, as far west between the mountains, the Appalachians, and the Rockies, what I recall was somebody reacting to John Keller saying, "That's terrible for you to say that. It is sinful for you to think that the church could even think about serving or appreciating alcohol." A few Canadians stood up and said, "That's absolutely nonsense. We serve alcohol regularly in our churches, in moderation for social gatherings." And here we were. Some people would not even serve wine at communion, thinking Jesus only made grape juice at the wine at the wedding in Cana. We really are not very clear. Now, I'm not proposing an answer. I guess I'm proposing a challenge for you to think about. Let me switch then to thinking about the disease concept of alcoholism. I ask you, first of all, to think what your reaction is when we say alcoholism is a disease. I'm certain that many of us can't possibly believe that emotionally. We were taught by people that knew very little, probably, that alcoholism was sinful, and the recipient of that disease was obviously a sinner and should be treated that way. And in the process, hundreds of thousands of people have died, and that many families have been destroyed. Well, alcoholism is a disease. You got to think in terms of three illness categories. One is physical illness, and I think we all understand that people can die with dignity. I mean, we don't think that somebody who has appendicitis is a sinner or has evil spirits or is demonic, for instance. We have a little trouble as a society, and particularly some Christian groups, with the idea of mental illness, because there's still some question about that being demonic. We don't talk about mental illness very much, but increasingly, it is acceptable to think about. There's a third category of illness that we call addictive illnesses. And that those group of illnesses we don't talk about publicly very much. We just don't like to think that any of us would be evil enough or weak enough to have enough willpower or somehow would have let our spiritual guard down to have gotten this horrible illness. And the illness is horrible, horrible, horrible. So we don't talk about it very much, particularly within spiritual circles, and I think that's where it should be spoken of. I think this is where it should be talked about. So alcoholism is one of the many addictive illnesses. The other illnesses in that constellation are chemical dependencies like cocaine addiction, marijuana dependency. They all have names like dependency or addiction. Alcoholism is a pure addiction. Marijuana, cocaine, and some of the other hallucinogenic chemicals primarily are not strictly addicting. It makes very little difference, but it's a technical matter. Well, any of us, all of us, are equal candidates for the disease alcoholism. Some of us have had the disease. Some of our children will have the disease. The incidence of alcoholism among Lutherans is slightly greater than it is among Catholics, by the way. The incidence of alcoholism among Scandinavians, which many of us come from that heritage, is slightly greater than it is among some other population. But overall, the prevalence is so widespread, it's at such an epidemic proportion, it's the greatest contributor to death in our country. It's the most popular illness in the nation. More people have alcoholism than anything else, other than the minor mental illnesses like depression or neuroses. It's the third major health problem in terms of cost, only behind cardiac and cancer, cardiac problems and cancer. But it is the single greatest theft of life, loss of life, because people die from alcoholism or related causes early in life. Tragic, tragic illness. And still, and I've always been angry at this and still am, still our church sits and is silent. So the disease has some characteristics that are worth mentioning. First of all, it's a chronic disease, like diabetes, for instance. Once you got it forever. It don't go away. It can be arrested, it can be, and it's highly treatable illness. But once you have it forever. Secondly, it's a progressive illness. That once you have it, it will get worse. It will not get better by itself. It will get worse. There may be plateaus, and even the progression may slow down at times, but it will get worse. And an untreated alcoholic will die an alcoholic, and he very likely will die as a result of, at least a contributing factor, is alcoholism. And third, it's a primary illness. And this is really important for anybody in the helping or the pastoral fields to recognize. It's a primary illness. It means you got to treat that before you can treat almost anything else. There are some medical exceptions to that, and there are some emergency exceptions. But for the most part, you don't do marital counseling effectively when there is alcoholism in the family. How can you do that when one member of the family can't think straight? You can't piece things together. You can't pray it away. You can't in some way counsel it away. You have to hit the addiction head on. A couple of words about the illness itself. It's the most, it's a multifaceted illness. My physician used the term, the only place I've ever heard it, calls alcoholism the perfect illness, medically the perfect illness. It affects everything in your life, absolutely everything. Alcohol, when it enters your system, affects every cell. The disease and the progression of the disease will affect every aspect of your life, physically, psychologically, socially, probably economically, probably vocationally. And what I'm most interested in here is spiritually. Alcoholics are very sick people, and they're, in all cases that I've treated them, spiritually bankrupt. And that's the most devastating aspect of the illness, but also the most promising. It's also where there's the most hope and where there's the most excitement and what gives me the greatest kick out of working with people. Because it's in that dimension that I see people growing and developing and flowering and flourishing. Now, I never saw that happen with people who had simple depression or mental illnesses. Alcoholics don't get well and get better because they're wonderful people. They're horrible people when they're sick. But they got to get well. They've got to be growing a little bit each day. And that's what AA is all about, and similar recovery groups. Well, treatment of alcoholism, I should say, by the way, there's no, it used to be thought that you had to drink 12 and a half years to be alcoholic. Not true. You can be alcoholic at your very first drink. There's a very strong genetic predisposition, and even if your parents didn't drink, or if you had alcoholic parents, for instance, and you don't drink, your children very likely will inherit part of, at least, this genetic predisposition. We don't understand a lot of this stuff very well because we have not recognized alcoholism as a disease, and we have not put the kind of money into research over the years. But we know that there's a genetic predisposition. It's very clear. There are some other dispositions too. If there's two times in your life you shouldn't drink, and this is what I tell in nearly any audience, is when you're an adolescent and when you're in the period of life that I have now entered in unwillingly, that we can call, we used to call this menopause for women. That's when men were writing textbooks. But since women are now writing textbooks, we have softer names like midlife or middlelessence. But those are the two times, primarily for women, when strenuous biological changes are taking place. We're seeing just a devastating amount of alcoholism with younger women, 13, 14, 15 years old. Bona fide alcoholics at 12 and 13. It's unbelievable. Well, most of us are not.
Another one to that, pregnancy is not another
question. Yeah. Pregnancy is not a time when you're apt to develop alcoholism, but pregnancy is a time when you can cause unusual damage to the fetus called the fetal alcohol syndrome. And the problem with that is that many young mothers particularly don't know they're pregnant at the time. There does not seem to be an acceptable amount of alcoholism, by the way, that can cause fetal alcohol. Obviously more can cause it, but it has to do with the timing during the first trimester of pregnancy. But that's not alcoholism. So most of us are not going to go through our teenage years again, but one of the things that I strongly advocate is all kinds of control measures to keep booze away from kids. See, I advocate at each legislative assembly that we should have the legal drinking age in our state to be 26. Obviously, people think that's wonderful, obviously. But think about that. The reason is that what alcoholism does is to totally arrest your maturation process, your psychological maturation process. When we treat alcoholics, chronologically, they may be 30, 40, 50, but typically they're 35. Maturationally, they frequently come out to be 15, 16 years old. What a horrendous problem that is. Here's a grown-up person trying to live life as a grown-up person. Hell, he's never been a teenager. You know, he never experienced that. So alcoholism has a way of arresting emotional growth. And I would advocate strong control measures as parents to keep booze away from kids. We know that all kids are gonna try to drink, but I would suggest they not do that until they're mature. Not many kids listen to that, but I think it's a position I have to take. Well, most of us are not gonna be adolescents again, but many of us will be in two other periods of our life when we're vulnerable to alcoholism, and that's the midlife period and the elderly, the senior period of our lives. During both of those periods, our bodies undergo tremendous changes, and we're now seeing an awful lot of senior citizens that are alcoholic, partially because there are more older people and they're healthier. But they continue to drink, you see, the same way they did when they were younger, and they might be on 6 or 8 different medications. There's a good deal of argument to say, so what if a 70, 80-year-old person becomes alcoholic? Don't they deserve that in their life? That's hard to argue with, but assuming then that it relieves some pain and so on, that's hard to argue with, but I would say yes, I would strongly want to treat that person because of the spiritual bankruptcy aspect. But don't fool yourself. Women, I speak directly to you women if I may, women become alcoholic overnight during this middle age period, and it's just horrible.
Is it mostly beer red or playing with women or hard stuff?
Well, women tend to be softer drinkers when they begin to drink, but by the time we see them in treatment, there's a book I think best describes the concept. It was "Cry Like a Woman, Drink Like a Man," and women don't tend to drink less or differently than men, particularly.
Same
drinking pattern. Well, it's usually a couple of things. Often it's reactive drinking because to their husband, or sometimes their husband's alcoholism, and it's often more closeted. And it's frequently, very frequently tied up with other sedative drugs, particularly Valium or Lyrica, that kind of thing. So that's the story of Betty Ford, for instance. Betty Ford is not to be looked at as some slut, right? She was a magnificent woman, and is. She became alcoholic overnight. That story is repeated all over. And it's kind of a tragedy. The divorce rate for alcoholic men, by the way, is about 10%. The divorce rate for alcoholic women is just about the reverse. It's somewhere in the 80-90%. You figure out what happens in alcoholism is we tend to behave in ways that are contrary to our values. And frequently that involves at least flirtatious, but often promiscuous kind of behavior. And it may not be right, but that's still more acceptable for men to do than for women. And when you think that happened only because a woman had an illness, it's really pretty tragic.
Would you define at what point you say someone's an alcoholic? Because you say a woman, this can happen overnight, or teenagers, et cetera. I'm aware of some of the genetic elements that you speak of, but how does one diagnose when one has crossed the barrier between social drinking and being an alcoholic?
Good question. And it's a big question in the field. A couple of things before I try to answer it. Number one, I'd say I would recommend that nobody in the room, unless you're a trained clinician, or physician, ever diagnose alcoholism. You don't diagnose other illnesses. I certainly wouldn't try to diagnose alcoholism. Secondly, I would never, ever call anybody with the illness an alcoholic. I would never do that. That's a very impolite, at best, term. I mean, we don't run around saying, this is the lady who had a hysterectomy. You know? Yet people feel very free to talk about somebody else's illness. That's not a response to your question, but it is to say, This is business for professionals. I think what you're really asking is, what time do we look at what I will call behaviors of concern? At what point are people abusing their privileges and acting inappropriately? Best way I can describe it is this way, that nearly all of us in the room have used, and probably do on some occasion, use alcoholic beverage. 90% of Americans do. It's very rare and uncommon that somebody abstains for their entire life. 70% of adult Americans use alcohol on a regular basis, and most have no problems. Only 1 in 10 people have the problem, but that turns out to be about 10 million Americans. It's more than any other disease that we know of. So most of us use alcohol. I don't think any of us in the room were drinking today, but very likely for those of us who are leaving the village in the next few days, we'll have a drink. Now think back to when you began drinking, when you were a young person, probably. In addition to using, most of us misused on some occasion. Now misuse is moderate impropriety. Okay? We got drunk or a little silly, or got silly at the wrong time, or unable to control our behavior, and just acted a little stupid, out of place.
Too talkative,
too loud, some. Okay. Most of us did that perhaps more than once, see? But those are the loud guys in a restaurant or on a train or... Most of us also, on at least one occasion, I'm not accusing anybody, I'm saying most of us, on at least one occasion, abused alcohol. Now, abuse is experiencing harmful consequences as a result of your drinking. Thrown up in the back seat, my wife one time passed out on our anniversary. That's abuse, right? Knocking over the Christmas tree, getting sick, going to the wrong house, leaving your wife, getting a drinking driving violation, doing something dumb where there were harmful consequences. Now, for most of us in North Dakota and Minnesota, I'm sure you'll recognize right away, you probably had a brother like I did. He was mean brother. And I remember in the winter, and I get just a little bit nervous when I think of this every time. I remember in the winter when he said, "Hey, did you ever put your tongue on your sled?" Remember when you put your tongue on your sled? Did anybody not put their tongue on their sled when they were grown-ups? Well, the problem is, did anybody, any of us do that twice? That's abuse, right? And we didn't do that twice. Unless we got some tremendous kick out of, more rewards from it. That's alcoholism. When the rewards exceed the penalty. When people know and expect harmful consequences, but drink anyway. That is the dividing line between alcoholism. Now, when we can find that gray line, I can't tell you. Usually we can only find it retrospectively, diagnostically. But that's where it is.
So it is, now I might be misunderstanding you, at the point of abuse when abuse is returned to by the individual.
Right. Okay. It's not the first time of abuse, see. I think we can expect, for those of us as parents, all of our kids to get drunk and come home drunk. And I try to teach parents how to help the kids enjoy that experience, enjoy the full experience of being drunk, see, the first time. If you never had a family meeting before, you don't talk to a person while they're drunk, by the way. They're not able to, most of us know that, but we forget that sometimes. But when you help them enjoy it is the next morning, see. Fry a little bacon. Bacon seems to have that smell kind of lingering. And don't fry it real good, though, right? Have it kind of slithering on the plate. Bring a couple of sunny side eggs and sort of throw those in there. Best to have an ice cream bucket handy. But help them enjoy the fullness of that moment. Well, See, most of us have done that. And I would hope that every kid we've ever dealt with could get so sick. And I think the thing is extended, too, into the cleanup period. That's part of the whole drinking experience. Let them enjoy that, the whole fulfilling moment. Now, if they do it again, knowing that's going to happen, see, that is where I think we cross the line into an alcohol problem. And I would not immediately diagnose alcoholism, but at that point, I think you have to suspect. See, I think a lot of people can get one DWI, for instance. You got to drink an awful lot, though, if you've never figured that out. Figure that out. When you hear someone, Johnny Carson says, had a couple of glasses of wine, my only response to Johnny Carson is bullshit. For somebody my size to get to an average DWI, average blood alcohol content for a DWI, will take 18 drinks in a 2-hour period. Okay. 8 for my size. Now, some of you are smaller than I, but you can't do it with less than 5 for most of us, and you're going to have at least 10 or 12. That's not a couple of glasses of wine. So I think when anybody gets a DWI, that's immediate suspicion, because that's tolerance, what we call in the field tolerance. These people are able to drink an awful, awful lot. But still, many people can do that, and to do it once, I think, is not a sense of immediate alarm. But if they do it twice, you see, that's where I think we say they've crossed the line, and they knew the penalty and yet sought the rewards anyway.
What's DWI?
Driving while intoxicated. In some states it's called DWI, driving under the influence.
Do you think that a person knows themselves when they are an alcoholic and can tell themselves? I know what you just said should, you know, answer that question, but I have a friend who says there is no way she will ever become an alcoholic because she knows when she has to stop having drink.
Yeah, she's wrong. She's wrong, but...
And I think so too, but she just really asked me about this. And it scares me because I felt it is a disease and it pounces on you. And
yeah, the number one, alcoholics, let me get back to the treatment just a little bit because I think that raises an issue. Alcoholism has, you know, a constellation of expectable and very reliable symptoms. One of them is the concept of denial, that alcoholics really do not know that they're alcoholic. They really do not know. I mean, somewhere in their heart they know, but in their head they really don't know. And they'll go on and perpetrate stupid behavior over and over and over again. And will deny and lie to, and it'll appear to you that they're lying to your face. Well, they're not lying. They really don't know this. They really don't. And part of the treatment is to, first of all, fracture this denial. And I kind of like that term, fracture, because addiction treatment is a very confronted, activistic treatment. Alcohol addiction counselors don't sit around and say, and I hear what you're saying. That's not quite the way they act. They tend to use a lot of strong language, confrontive language, brutal language, because the disease itself is brutal. Now, I hope you won't take offense with this or think poorly of me, but in my interviewing of somewhere around 1,000 or more incoming patients, one of the last questions that I've asked all patients, I'm speaking of males now particularly because females use different language, but I think this peaks up the kind of suffering that I believe is there and our spiritual need to respond to it. When I ask people how they would describe themselves, the typical male response, and I would guess this is 80 to 85% of male white patients, will say, I'm a real asshole. Now, they don't say that in a flippant way. Think about what this man is saying. That's their self-concept. And my response has to be, God didn't put people here to be assholes. See? That's not the way I think we expected people to live. And I think we can change that. And when we give them that hope, I think people respond and can begin moving. Now, they're not trying to be vulgar when they think about themselves. They are so low that it's unbelievable. I think I first truly understood the suffering in alcoholism. During one Lenten season, we did a series of plays on the book of Job. And I can't remember the title of it, but there was a script, but you make up a lot of the actions. And I was Job. And my job was to convince my congregation of the suffering. None of you ever read the book of Job thoroughly. But think of this man had boils and lost his crops, lost his children. I mean, he was spurned and spurned and spit out from God, and yet he remained faithful. And that's the good news. But the suffering he went through, the humiliation, the universality of his life being dismal, that's what alcoholism is. Everything is affected. Everything suffers. And the loss is so incredible, and the spiritual bankruptcy is so incredible, that that's the way people see themselves. They're worthless, they're shut off from God. We flippantly, in treatment center, I kid my Catholic friends that I'd rather treat Catholics, and this is, by the way, not quite so flippant, but it's more meant in humor, but Catholics have guilt. See? And guilt is something rational and we can deal with therapeutically, even cognitively. Lutherans have shame. So interestingly, somatically, I can identify with Catholic patients. Catholic patients have pain in their abdomen and their breast. Lutherans have somatic pain in their genitals. That's pretty deep-seated pain. That is shame. Well, I don't know. I hope you've never experienced shame, and I certainly hope you never will. But shame means that you have committed a sin against God that is so unforgivable that he will never talk to you again. Ever, ever, ever. You are worthless, totally worthless.
It's worse than guilt, you say.
Absolutely worth. It is, that's right. It is horrible. Shame is the kind of thing that when I talk to patients, that's the kind of thing that the Cheyenne sent the lonely brave out from the tribe forever. He was never to return, because he had committed some horrible atrocity. And that's the way alcoholics feel. I mean, that there is no hope in their life, typically. Absolutely no hope that they can be reborn or rejuvenated or fixed in any way.
And the church, you said, is silent. I'm interested in what some of your ideas are for rectifying that. Education, more from the pulpit, what do you think?
Well, while our church, among others, have been silent, and the church's position on alcoholism is not one, honestly, we can feel proud of. Some of the finest and the best leaders in the addiction field are Lutheran pastors. Among them, Phil Hansen from Minneapolis, John Keller from now in Chicago, but formerly from Minnesota. And I know a number of other pastors, Lutheran pastors, who are just dynamite in this field. And one of the real addictive illnesses is to find a sympathetic, concerned pastor and put them dealing with alcoholics for a while. They become addicted immediately to working with alcoholics forever. They're hooked. Just hooked. So there are, I would think our best response is to have pastors begin dealing with people with the illness. I don't know if we can.
As counselors?
Yeah, not as counselors, but as spiritual.
Are you advocating, you know, that we talk more about, emphasize abstinence?
No.
Over against moderate?
No, I think I would not talk abstinence at all, because and this would be a controversial position, but my position is that alcohol is one of God's gifts, and it should be used, and should be used moderately, if at all. In other words, I don't advocate that people use alcohol, but I also don't advocate that people abstain. The greatest incidence of alcoholism, by the way, occurs in abstaining populations. American Indians, Mormons, lowest occurs in frequent users, Italians, Jews, so on. So abstinence is not seen to be the answer. And if somebody wants to take a personal or family position on abstinence, I would certainly support that.
Education maybe is the most important.
Yeah, I think education and understanding and compassion. You know, I think first of all, the compassion that people get this disease and it's highly treatable, and that this is a spiritual response. See, among the things that I see in my church, for instance, I was chairman of my congregation until fairly recently, and I work right now in a number of interchurch groups. If alcoholics are 10% of the Lutheran population, they're vastly overrepresented on those kinds of groups. As I go to the church, to the Sunday school teacher's picnic, for instance, it looks to me like half the people in our church teaching Sunday school are recovering alcohol. You know, you may have that experience. You may not know who recovering alcoholics are. And maybe you shouldn't. Maybe it doesn't make any difference. What I am saying is these people are tremendously service-minded in the church.
When you say that abstaining, it's the groups that have the least problems are the ones who don't abstain. I find it hard when you said earlier that you say that the drinking age should be put up to 26. Because I'm past the legal age and it's never really mattered all that much to me, but I've always been told that the Jews have a very low problem with alcoholism because it's incorporated into their life all the way throughout their life, same with Italians. And it seems like when you have the legal ages, it just makes some people react against that and think that it's kind of a rite of passage.
Yeah, and you're right, you're right. But I guess my position is that for those that of the 10% of our population will be alcoholic no matter what, they're difficult to treat when they're teenagers. How do you treat a teenager? How do you rehabilitate a teenager when you can say, if you sober up, you can have all this acne and all this back? So very difficult to do. So I say it's flippant. I think nobody is ever going to do it.
Are you saying since we have the problem anyway, it's been hard to change?
Well, there's obviously much more to talk about. I do thank you for your time, and if you want to chat with me further, I'll still be around. Thank you very much.